This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 180, You've Got Mail. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Will Wynn. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the untimely death of composer James Horner, a new way for listeners to join us on a podcast discussion, and we debate which DS9 character would make the best captain. Then in the feature, we're joined by Sue Kay and Jeffrey Harlan to discuss the DS9 episode, His Way. So throw on your dress or tux, and let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Will. It's great to have you back with me here in the Ready Room to talk some Deep Space Nine. I'm glad you're on this show because I know, like me, you are a huge Niner. How's everything been going?
It's been going well, and I'm glad to be back. I mean, definitely a Niner, also a Boomer, so I think I'm always glad to be on the Ready Room when you're talking DS9.
That should be your call sign, Niner Boomer. Come in, Niner Boomer.
Yes, in my new spinoff that's also BSG related too, I guess.
Well, I was thinking if we could work Niner Boomer in to be a call sign in Star Wars, maybe you can get your own standalone Disney film.
Are you listening to that, Disney / Marvel / Kevin Feige? Bring me in that universe. It'd be great.
Bring you on in. Well, I am really excited that we're recording another Ready Room this weekend because it's been tough with my work schedule for a while now to get the Ready Room back to weekly. And Larry and I sat down with Adam Nimoy last week and recorded, and I got that show right out. And here we are again this week recording a new Ready Room. Very exciting. And, you know, this week for me, finally, something I've been working towards for a while happened, and I have joined the official website, StarTrek.com, as a member of their team of regular bloggers. I have a new column on there called Trekspectives that I'll be writing every month. And I'm glad I'm finally doing that.
Congratulations, by the way. I was going to say on the other side of the room, that's a huge deal. Like, congrats. Like, how did that come about, actually?
It's been a long process of talking to them, you know, behind the scenes for a while, pitching my idea. And the first column's actually been ready for maybe like a month. And it, you know, takes time to get the first one published and get things rolling. And I'm the kind of person where I keep everything really quiet until it actually happens. So I think only a few people, Larry, Matthew, Shar, and Norm, maybe, I think, are the only people who knew that was coming up. I wanted it to actually be live on the website because you never know, you know, things fall through. But it's there now. First column is just an intro to Trekspectives, and I talk about my journey of how I became a Star Trek fan, why I created Trek FM, and, you know, how Star Trek sticks with me all through life. And I've been getting a good reaction. I think that my story mirrors that of lots of you guys listening. So if you haven't read it yet, go over to StarTrek.com. You'll see it there, Trekspectives, A Journey of Fandom. And I'll have new ones coming out every month. All right, well, let's jump into the news here. And the first bit of news we have is very sad. This is something that I found out about because Larry sent me a DM and said, did you hear about James Horner? And I said, no. And he said, well, apparently he was just killed in a plane crash. And then I had to go and look up the news. Actually, Larry sent me a link to something in the LA Times there. And I was so sad. James Horner, he wrote two of my favorite Star Trek scores, The Wrath of Khan and The Search for Spock, as well as Titanic, which is another one of my favorite film scores. And I mean, what was your reaction when you heard this, Will?
It's just been a terrible year. I think we've been doing these types of stories far too often for my liking. And it's so surreal that we're having this type of conversation yet again in such a relatively short period of time. And, you know, I think I put James Horner on the same level as, you know, Hans Zimmer, John Williams, Danny Elfman, yeah, in terms of those really iconic music pieces, those really iconic movie soundtrack, movie scores. And for me, the piece he did for Wrath of Khan is definitive because it really captures the sense of that movie, that yeah, really naval, swashbuckling Horatio Hornblower. It wouldn't be Wrath of Khan without James Horner's music.
Right.
But outside of that, I mean, I love his theme from Rocketeer. It's probably my favorite of his works. And his work has just been spread out through so many great movies. And I think the most sad and tragic thing is that he was a relatively young artist and musician. He still had so much more work ahead of him. So I think this is something yeah, that we're going to feel in terms of his impact.
Oh, definitely. He was 61 years old. And of course, he scored many famous movies. I mentioned Titanic, you know, Avatar, Cocoon, Aliens, Field of Dreams, Apollo 13, A Beautiful Mind, The Amazing Spider-Man, but also he had work coming up. I mean, there's some of his compositions we haven't heard yet. We will hear with Southpaw, Wolf Totem, and the 33 coming up. And you know that there's so much more that he had in him that we're going to miss out on, which is very, very sad. And you talk about The Wrath of Khan, and I always say, and I feel, and I know many fans feel, that Star Trek as we know it today probably wouldn't exist without The Wrath of Khan. That was do or die after the motion picture, which is a film that I do like. I know many fans don't, but the motion picture, let's face it, that was not going to propel Star Trek into what it ended up being. And The Wrath of Khan, the success of that film, both critically with the audience, creatively, gave us the rest of Star Trek. And the music is a big part of that as well. And so without James Horner's work on that film, Star Trek may be different than it is today. It may sound strange to some people to say that the music would have that much of an impact, but watch a film without the music. I mean, even if you could turn off the music and keep the dialogue of a film, it's totally different without the music. So Horner's creative vision was just as integral to the success of that as Nick Meyer and anyone else involved. And it's really, really sad that we've lost him. It's just been such a rough year for us. And also, Will, the first thing I thought of when I found out it was him solo in a plane crashing was that we almost lost Harrison Ford a few months ago from the same thing.
Exactly, yeah. And that was just like right after Leonard Nimoy's death too, like right yeah, on the heels of it.
Yeah, yeah. So, rough year. So, yeah, you know, go watch any of these films that he scored. Get the soundtracks. I've got many of them in my library. I love listening to just the music. And we'll always remember James Horner.
That's true.
And also, I don't think this has dropped yet, but I'm pretty sure that Matthew and Norm are planning to do a supplementary episode on the 602 Club about James Horner. So keep your eyes out for that. I think that is coming down the pipe here. So Will, another thing that you guys have been doing, speaking of Norm, you guys have kicked off our Patrons Roundtable, which is a way for us to get our patrons who support the network financially involved by bringing them on and talking Trek with us. Tell us a little bit about that and what that experience was like.
Yeah, so it's actually been in the pipeline for a while, and we just actually launched our inaugural episode last week, and I'm really excited because it just gives us an opportunity to have a free-flowing conversation with other hosts down the road from other Trek FM shows, which we wouldn't have the opportunity to normally interact with, but also to have patrons on the show interacting and also participating too. And it's just a way for us to thank them for the support that they give us, which is absolutely critical in bringing programming to our listeners each and every week. And it's just great to hear from them and actually interact with them. And I was on there with Ken Tripp and Jeff Harlan, who's actually going to be in today's Ready Room. And Ken Tripp was just wonderful. And it was his first time behind the mic ever. And mm-hmm. he was just a natural. And
he did a great job. Yeah.
Yeah. And the conversation that we had with Jeff and Norm was just free flowing and just talked about our experiences as Star Trek fans, why Star Trek appeals to us, and then how we found Trek FM. And I think it was really insightful to kind of talk about our experiences with Trek FM, because that's how I became involved with the network, how I became a host is through Patreon, through interacting with other fans. And I think it's wonderful that within a short period of time, both me and Norm and now Trip, Ken and Jeff have become more involved in our fandom. And I think Ken's going to get a real kick out of me calling him Trip as in Trip Tucker accidentally through that.
Well, I don't know. I had a long conversation with Ken as well myself, and I forgot to ask him if he likes pan fried catfish. Maybe he does. And so if so,
the pecan pie
would be quite appropriate.
So like I said, I think it was a wonderful conversation. It was really tough to actually keep it to an hour, which was my original goal. We plan on having this each and every month with a rotating panel of different hosts and patrons, and we're going to have different topics. It's going to be Trek related, but it's going to be very open-ended. So I think it's going to be a great avenue.
It's very casual, and you can listen to it. It's in the master feed, and you can get that anywhere that the master feed's available. So the master feed is, of course, available on iTunes, but it's also on Stitcher and TuneIn. I think it's on Windows Phone. It's on SoundCloud as well. It's on Spreaker. The master feed's not on Spreaker, but the Roundtable is, because we have a show on there called Supplemental, where we put just kind of random things like movie commentaries and such. So you can hear it there, and SoundCloud. Again, you can even download the file and you can stream it on the website. So there are many ways that you can listen to this Roundtable yourself, even though it's not part of an actual show, weekly show, you know, like the Ready Room or Warp 5 or those shows. And, you know, for me, listening back to it, I really enjoyed hearing you guys talk about how you got involved in Trek FM, how you found us, and especially what it means to you. Because one thing that keeps me going is hearing from the listeners, either on the roundtable or in the Babel Conference, or people just sending me messages about how the shows we do help you grow your fandom, help make your days better, help make your commutes better. Exercising. I think Ken said that he listens a lot when he's at the gym exercising, and he's always on
the road. I also
do
that too. Just
and you do that too. A lot of people do that. Yeah. And that means a great deal to me. And so I really enjoyed hearing that as well. As I said, it's casual. So we don't do all the editing like we do for our other shows. And we use the online audio, which we don't do on our other shows. And so the sound quality is not quite as polished as what you're accustomed to, but the content's just great, I thought, on the first one. And there's no set number. Like, this first one is two hosts and two patrons, but it's not always like that. It could be three hosts and four patrons or whatever. It's whoever's available at the time that we're going to do it, if you're there. And it's for our patrons at the $25 level or higher. It is a perk. You know, it's not meant to exclude anyone. It's just a perk for those who support the network, because without the support of these patrons, we really can't publish. It's very, very expensive to operate the network. So anyway, Roundtable, it was fantastic. So Will, thank you for organizing that and getting it off the ground. It is something that I had been trying to do for quite a while and did not get it off the ground, but you did.
Yeah, I was just excited to be a part of it, because I remember when I was signing for Patreon, I wanted to be a part of that. So I'm all like, I want this to actually happen. I know that there's a lot of other people that want to as well. So I was happy to do it.
Yeah. And now you're running it. So that's
there you
great.
Go.
Patreon, by the way, please go over to patreon.com/trekfm, patreon.com/trekfm. That's where you can support us. You can contribute any amount that you like on a month-to-month basis. It's really important for us keeping the network going, as I said. You can see all the different perks and the levels there. And we hope that you'll join Ken and Jeffrey and everyone else and support us over there. And we really, really thank you from the bottom of our hearts, which sounds like a song that Vic Fontaine would sing, right, Vic? But we really mean it. We thank you for your
That's
support.
True.
Okay, let's go on to the other thing we're going to talk about here in the news segment today. We haven't done this in a while here. It's a poll on StarTrek.com. And this one is the DS9 character who'd make the best captain is. And they had nearly 10,000 votes. And the staff at StarTrek.com said they were totally surprised by who won. But actually, Will, I wasn't surprised at all. The person I voted for won. And for me, they were really the no-brainer choice. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just there are maybe two or three people who I can see being possible winners here. But for me, this was the one. Who was that person?
Jadzia Dex.
Yep. Do you agree that Jadzia would make the best captain? 32% of voters said that she would.
Absolutely. Absolutely, because I've always been of the opinion that they should have promoted Jadzia to captain in either season 6 or season 7 and promoted Sisko to admiral. I know that's not the... Not everyone would have liked that, but I think it would have shown a real progression because Dax wasn't commander of the Defiant. She just didn't have the captain's rank, but I felt that would have been such great character growth for her. And she's such a natural in command. She wasn't commander of the Defiant for quite some time, and that makes a lot of sense. So for me, it is a little surprising that StarTrek.com was surprised by this result. But I also think it's interesting that the second place is right behind Jadzia, and it's her Parmakai, Worf, right? Right at 31%. Yeah.
Maybe they could be co-captains. They're a captain couple.
What's Starfleet's regulation on having a married couple being co-captain?
I don't know.
Oh, man.
I don't know if there's anything on the books about that. I don't know if it's ever come up before.
That's true. But I mean, but also Worf makes sense, too.
Yeah, he does. Especially Worf towards the end of DS9. Now, Worf, when he came aboard DS9... I would say no. And Worf on TNG, I would definitely say no to having him as a captain. But Worf, as you get into season 7 especially, after he has spent so much time under the mentorship of Martok and Sisko, and also Jadzia, because her wisdom that comes from her many lifetimes really help. And I'm even going to throw Ezri in there, because I think Ezri really helped refine Worf as a person there in season 7. I think by the time you get to the end of season 7, Worf is someone who I would totally feel comfortable serving under if he were my captain.
Absolutely.
But prior to that, no. I would think I would probably get myself killed.
That's also very true. And also happens to coincide with Michael Dorn's continuing efforts to get a Captain Worf TV show on. So he's probably referring to this poll as evidence for a Captain Worf, a demand for a Captain Worf show.
And probably very disappointed that he got edged out by Terry Farrell.
whose character is no longer alive.
Right. Exactly. Third place with 22%. I don't know if we mentioned the percentages with Worf. So it's 32% Jadzia, 31% Worf. So it was really, you know, neck and neck, and which is why they should be co-captains. 22% Kira. Again, I think, Kira by the end of the series, I think would make a good captain. And in fact, she does become the head of the space station after Sisko is gone. Now, Kira, through most of the series, I don't think she would make a good captain because I don't think that she was able to make good decisions. She allowed her emotions to influence her decisions too much. And now Sisko also is a somewhat emotional leader, but I think he makes good decisions most of the time. I think someone like Picard is probably more the prototypical Starfleet captain who's really able to separate his emotions from his command. And Kira really couldn't do that through most of the series.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think you really have a development of Nerys through the entire show where she is evolving into from a terrorist, from a resistance fighter, into a fully realized individual that can take command and deal with various personalities in various situations. And it makes sense that by the book, you know, in the books, you know, she does become captain. I mean, in season 7, she's given a provisional rank of commander. She's showing that type of command potential. So it makes a lot of sense.
Well, the way that she works together with Damar in the final chapter shows me that she has what she needs in order to actually be a captain and be a good leader.
Absolutely.
So after that, we have Miles, and Miles came in here with just 8%. I think Miles would be kind of a cool captain to have if you worked on a small ship somewhere and it was a small crew of, you know, like 15 or 20 people. But as a starship captain, yeah, I don't really see that working.
I feel like this could be the perfect spinoff for Starfleet Corps of Engineers, the engineering ship commanded by Miles O'Brien, right? Something like that. Because he's very much enlisted. That's what I love about Miles O'Brien. He's very much an enlisted man. He doesn't like command. That's why he's enlisted, right? But he can take command when he needs to. But does he really want to? And does he have, you know, the personality or kind of the intention to be the captain 24/7, 365?
Yeah.
Not so much.
Yeah. I think he has the knowledge and the experience to do it. But that's only part of what it means to be a leader, to be someone who's leading the entire crew 24/7 or 27/7, whatever it is on page one.
That's true. I'm using a very Earth-centric.
Yeah, you're being time very, measurement. I mean, just listen to you. Yeah, Earth's the center of the universe, huh, Will?
I am. I'm very being I'm pretty much the founding member of Terra Prime, essentially. I'm pretty much right along Paxton, I guess.
Okay.
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no, you're not like that. Will's not like that at all, guys. Okay, so the last three here. 3% Odo. Yeah, I cannot see Odo being a captain. 2% Bashir. Nope, that wouldn't work either. I think, kind of like Miles, I think Bashir can take command in certain situations when he needs to, especially later in the series, but he's not cut out to be a captain. And then Quark at 2%. Can you imagine Quark as a captain?
But wasn't he a captain in Little Green Men? Briefly?
Oh, that's right. That is true.
And he was a terrible captain, but he was right. A captain, right? He's like, I don't care about your techno babble, Rom. Just make it go faster.
I love that line, by the way. He's the viewer. He's the DS9 writers, right?
Yeah.
Look at the techno babble. Let's just get on. Let's just get the ship crashed so we can get on with the story. You know? All right. So that's the poll. We'll keep it nice, short, and sweet here today. Interesting poll, though. It is interesting to think about who would make a good captain on the crew, who's not. And I think the right people are up there at the top here. But let us know what you think. You can let us know on the Babel Conference on Facebook, our listeners group. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and that'll take you right over there. Or you can click discussion on our website. But it's a closed group, so you'll need to click join. And the admins will let you write in. Will's an admin. I am as well. Norm and Matthew are. And we invite everyone in. We only talk about it here on the air, though, on the shows. So the people who are there, they listen to the shows. And so we have discussions just like we do here on the network there. And also, you know, Twitter, our username is Trek.fm. Our website, trek.fm/contact, is our contact form. So let us know what you think about the poll. Also, any thoughts on James Horner? So that's all we have to talk about in news for this week, Will. So let's go ahead and bring in Jeffrey and Sue and talk about some more DS9 and his way.
You're nobody till somebody loves you. You're nobody till somebody cares. Now you may be king, you may possess the world and its gold, but gold won't bring you happiness when you're growing old. The world is still the same, you'll never change it.
When you can start a show with a lengthy cold open featuring a tuxedo-clad James Darren crooning a jazz standard and do it on a Cardassian-built space station in the 24th century, you know you've got something special. And that's just what the Deep Space Nine writers did near the end of the show's sixth season with His Way. It was the culmination of a game of romantic cat and mouse between Odo and Kira, but also solidified a creative freedom that would ensure that DS9's final season would not be hindered by a studio that would make the show square. There are no Clydes or Harveys allowed in this ready room as we discuss how a light bulb with pretty sweet pipes gave DS9 a special twist. And to help us do this, we're joined by two first-time guests here on the ready room. From Women at Warp, we have Sue Kay. Sue, welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Great to have you here in the ready room for the very first time.
It's exciting.
And also glad to have you and your colleagues on Women at Warp here on the network.
Yes, we're excited to join the network, too.
Yeah, we've been getting a great response, and it's so great to have more women on the network with us here. And also we have with us, for the first time on the Ready Room, someone you've heard alongside Will a few times over on Warp 5 and also on the recent Patrons Roundtable, Mr. Jeffrey Harlan. Jeffrey, welcome.
Hi, glad to be here on the Ready Room as well.
Yeah, great to have you. So today we're going to talk about His Way. This is one of my favorite DS9 episodes, maybe because I'm a musician and I used to play jazz for years and years. And I love the fact that the writers could take jazz and really make it a part of the science fiction show. It's not the one-off kind of thing like we would get on TNG, you know, say with Riker and Minuet and the trombone, but it actually, you know, Vic becomes a character on this show, which is really amazing to me. So before we talk about the episode itself, a quick synopsis for those of you who haven't seen this episode or haven't seen it in a while. And actually, Will, you're a big Niner just like me, so why don't you do the synopsis for us?
Sure. So basically, the episode synopsis is Julian brings aboard a new self-aware hologram called Vic Fontaine. It's the explanation isn't really important in terms of how he is created. Basically, he has a new holoprogram. He introduces Vic to everyone, and Vic has this just instant ability to size someone up. So they can size up the fact that, you know, Miles is missing Keiko, the fact that Jadzia and Worf are married, and also the fact there's some significant romantic and sexual tension between Nerys and Odo.
Oh, okay. And I thought you were going to say Miles and Jules, because they were sitting over there also by the
bar. I wish there was a His Way part two, because it would have explored all of that relationship, and I would have totally been down for that. I would have watched the heck out of that, actually. So that kicks off the episode. Essentially, Vic takes on Odo. You know, he's his wingman. He's his mentor on life, his life coach. And it's a whole relationship of getting Odo to loosen up and get his feelings known to Kira. And that relationship develops at the end, but with a little bit of hijinks in terms of a bait and switch with a hologram and some musical numbers. So I think it's a very fun and very unique twist to the characters we've seen so far on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, most definitely. Okay, awesome. So that's the synopsis. And Sue, what are your first impressions of His Way? Have you seen this episode many times? Did you watch DS9 for the first time fairly recently?
No. I watched, my Star Trek history started with the first episode of The Next Generation, and I went straight through before I went back to see TOS and more recently the animated series. Good times. So I saw this when it aired first time around, and I've seen it a few times since then. But, I mean, I was raised on a pretty steady diet of Frank Sinatra, Katharine Hepburn movies, and Star Trek. So hits me right in a sweet spot, you know?
Just all right.
The fact that there are these jazz standards throughout. And it's, especially for a later episode in DS9, it is certainly lighter fare for that show. And it's welcome at that time, you know. At least that's how I feel. Late in season
Definitely.
Six.
Yeah, they did a good job of putting a few light moments in the latter seasons like that.
Yeah, it's a good palate cleanser because it comes right after Inquisition and In the Pale Moonlight, which are probably the heaviest episodes they do.
Yeah, that's right. It comes not long after In the Pale Moonlight, so you would expect Odo to look at Vic and go, "It's a fake!"
That's true.
When he finds out that it's not really Kira.
It's true. I also feel like the technology behind Vic, I love the premise, but it's almost, I think we're going to get into it later, but just that's a huge technological breakthrough for Vic to exist and to be self-aware and to turn himself on and off. And they're just like, yeah, it's a fun thing, but that's essentially artificial intelligence, right? They've essentially made, you know, Data. If Data is so unique, you know, Vic Fontaine should be this huge technological breakthrough that everyone should be like, wow, this is a huge thing. But they're just like, yeah, he's a fun hologram.
Well, Jeffrey, what did you think about this episode?
I thought it was very interesting that the song they were singing to open it up is "You're Nobody Till Somebody Loves You."
Yep.
Which was very appropriate for the theme of the episode. And I loved Vic as a character. He brought out things for the rest of the cast that I really don't see them bringing out as easily without his character there.
Definitely.
For them to play against. especially in season 7, the things that they did with them later. And it was nice to see a lighter episode right after some of these heavy episodes. The Dominion War is in full force at this point. And so you need to step back every now and then and just kind of relax and not have it be all dark, all war, yeah, all the time. Otherwise, it gets very hard to watch that all the time.
Well, it's like what Matthew and I talk about on The Orb sometimes, is that at its core, you know, DS9 is, people think of it as the war show, but even in these later seasons when the war is going on, the show is not really about the war. The show is about the characters. The show is about the fact that these people have their own lives in the midst of this war. And in the darker episodes, it shows how the war affects them on a personal level. But in episodes like this, it also shows that life goes on and there may be a war going on around you, but they're still concerned with their daily lives and their personal relationships. Let's talk about Vic a bit more here, because you brought up what he means to the other characters and things that they couldn't bring out, perhaps, without him being there. So, Sue, with Vic as a character on the show, it's kind of unexpected, right, to introduce a lounge singer as a main character in a science fiction show. But in terms of relationships, you know, with the other characters, what do you see there?
I think that he is, because everything's so heavy on DS9, because it's the war show, it just what you said, he allows the other characters to sort of let loose and let things out that they wouldn't normally. You know, you'd never expect, whether or not he's trying to court Kira, you'd never expect Odo to sit down and play the piano, or even hologram Kira to get up and turn into a crooner. And it's just, it's their escape. You know, they have the holosuite anyway, but having, I think, a self-aware character there, an AI, if you will, who remembers them, it's easier. You forget sometimes, I guess, that you're going into a fantasy. It's different than a regular holosuite program.
And Vic kind of becomes the counselor of the station, right?
Close enough to a bartender.
Yeah, well, he does here, and then in It's Only a Paper Moon, he is the counselor to Nog as well. So until Ezri gets here, he really fills in that role of counselor. And even after Ezri gets here, I mean, Matthew and I call Ezri the confused counselor, because she's technically a counselor. That's her role in Starfleet, but she really, after the symbiont gets in her, she doesn't know who she is, so she can't really perform that role. So Vic does it instead.
Yeah, I think he serves as a good catalyst for the other characters, and things can happen a little more easily when he's around.
Definitely. What about you, Will?
Yeah, I can only echo what everyone else has said, too. Just that first interaction, just, I laugh every time the way he's going through, you know, a Clyde, a Harvey, a square, and then Miles says, you know, one side of a cube, right? And he's all like, oh, then you answer my own question. Right. Like, it cracks me up every time, because it's such perfect delivery, because Miles just gives it very matter-of-factly. You know, it's one side of a cube, I get it, right? And he's all like, it just goes over everyone's head, because it's so contextual. It's, you know, centuries old jargon and lingo, but it works so well.
Well, it's like Geordi not understanding I have to take a leak in First Contact.
I know. One of the best moments of First Contact. So good. But overall, I think Vic, in especially that first scene, because, you know, it's a cold open. He's just singing. So you're just like, what's going on? It's probably a holodeck. But then you understand that this is just more than the standard holodeck episode, which is why this episode, I think, works, because it flips on its head what the audience has come to expect from holodeck episodes from both TNG, Voyager at this time. It's flipping it in a way that by the end of the episode, I think people really see Vic as a character as opposed to just a holodeck adventure that the Enterprise crew gets into.
Right.
And for once, nothing goes wrong.
That's right.
That's true.
In fact, something goes right, I guess. They come together. Although they don't, Kira and Odo don't come together in the holodeck. They do leave not wanting to talk about what happened, but then ultimately it works out.
That's a great, I mean, that was a great procession, like how that episode ends, and I think we'll get to it too, but how that actually ends up working, I think just the acting, I feel like it was just so on point in this episode, especially between Nana Visitor and Renee Auberjonois. It's so good.
The best part of that ending isn't the two of them. It's Terry Farrell's expression when she sees them kissing.
That's true. And it's all in her eyes. It's all in her face, right? And even even the expressions from the other Bajoran crew members and just people in the promenade, it was just because they recognize who these people are. That's Kira and Odo. Oh, they're kissing each other. It's a big deal. So,
but Jadzia especially, you can see her going like, no, you go, true. Kira.
I know. After she's been needling her all episode about Shakar, right? It was really good.
Exactly. What else do you have to say about Vic?
I think going forward, I don't want to get into other episodes that he's in, but I think this is almost the perfect episode for him to be introduced in. I think later on you'll have episodes where things do go wrong, or like in Bada Bing, Bada Bang, where like there are things that to continue the trope or to continue his relevance, he may stretch a little, or he may kind of exceed what the audience accepts to be believable. But I think this episode is the perfect episode for Vic. Other episodes are definitely enjoyable with him in it, don't get me wrong. But I think this is the one where it works the best. His first introduction is the one that makes the most sense. He's the most integral to what the characters are doing in terms of interactions. And I think it speaks a lot that I think this episode, because it was so successful, made the other episodes down the road possible. Obviously, I think it got to a point where it was slightly diminishing returns, but at the same time, still enjoyable. But I think this was definitely the best appearance of Vic Fontaine.
Well, talking about them stretching believability, we were talking on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
And Jeffrey, I think it was you who pointed out that he can make calls on the comm system while he's deactivated.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and he's making calls to the chief of security of the station while he's apparently deactivated, and the isolinear rod containing his program is not even connected to the station's computers.
It's in a box
and
under Quark's bar.
It's in a box under the bar, and no one is freaking out about this.
That's true. That's so true.
That just shows that Vic's a very special guy.
I don't think his program was actually in the rod. I think the first time they put him in, he downloaded himself into the station's computer.
Which makes it even more frustrating. I mean, it's even more perplexing that they're not worried that, he's actually in our computers now. It's not even
That's the only way that he could have done that when he's unplugged.
Does that mean that Vic's like a virus?
Quite possibly.
I can see like future occupants of the station. They trip something like in Babel at the beginning of DS9 where they trip something and they all cannot speak anymore. Future residents trip something and suddenly there's jazz music everywhere and there's this guy in a tuxedo roaming around. Like, what the hell is going on?
That would not be a bad thing.
That would be DS9 Season 8.
Well, it is a good point about him being in the computer, though, because in this episode, it's very clear that you have to go and you have to get that ride. But later, they do establish, right, Vic is a program that's just running all the time. And
that's not until later.
Until later. And they get him in the system. And then beyond the TV series, when you get into the books, they are able to save his program when the station is, spoiler alert, I won't tell you when it happens, but if you've seen cover art, you know that eventually there is a new DS9, a Federation-built DS9. And so when Tarak Nor is ultimately destroyed, they are able to save his program and bring him forward to the new station. So the implication there is that he really was part of the station. It wasn't like Quark could just grab that box of isolinear chips and run away with him.
Yeah, I think this also dovetails to what I was saying on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
In terms of when they introduce Vic, you know, he's essentially saying that Felix said, who we never see, by the way, he's just Bashir's friend who is apparently a master hologram technician, hologram creator, that he created this program that is self-aware, right? A self-aware hologram that knows it's a hologram, which I think for me is such that's a huge deal, let alone the fact that he can survive on the station's computers. He's self-aware. That's a huge step towards artificial intelligence and sentience. And, you know, we were dealing with artificial intelligence and the issues of sentience in, you know, Next Generation. So much of it was about that. And this obviously is a huge step forward, but they treated it like it was no big deal.
Yeah.
It was just like, oh, it's a nice little quirk or a nice little feature for it to have. And for me, I think I just go with it, because if I just start nitpicking it, I'm just not going to enjoy the episode.
Sure.
But there's a part of me that says, like, wow, this is a huge deal, right? This should revolutionize everything.
Yeah. And at this point, also, we have Voyager on the air, so we're also dealing with this issue with the Doctor as well.
That's true.
Right.
That's
that was going to be my point, is that Voyager started in 95, and they had a self-aware hologram.
Yeah.
So if they have an EMH already, Vic really isn't that much of a step forward, I don't think.
Data's been around for almost 30 years at this point, too.
Yeah, of course, Data's a bit different because he physically exists. Right. But the Next Generation, like with Moriarty, you already got into something where a hologram could be self-aware, which paved the way for the Doctor on Voyager and then for Vic here also.
So maybe after all those years of all these other AIs and robots and androids and everything, maybe it's by this point, it's like, oh, okay, not a big deal. We've seen this before.
Yeah, that's why Felix is so good. He's spending all of his nights studying the schematics of other holograms.
So does Felix look like James Darren?
I bet Felix and Lewis Zimmerman probably hang out together in the bars.
Well, the issue for me here, though, is that Vic is trapped in the computer / the hollow suite / wherever there are hollow emitters, whereas once he gets the mobile emitter, the Doctor is not, right? So
no, the Doctor is footloose and fancy free. So.
Right.
In his leisure suit.
But
it's true.
I mean, what is preventing Vic from becoming the next Moriarty? Like, he could, you know, get a little crazy, if you will. I hate using that word. But he could be, he's stuck in there. And he knows he's stuck in there. And he knows he's not experiencing the passage of time like everybody else. So there's nothing really to prevent him from having some kind of psychotic break and becoming evil. So where is the line between this character that was created and was just locked away for good, and this character that was created, this life that essentially exists to provide entertainment to Deep Space Nine's crew? It's very squishy, ethically, yeah. I feel.
Well, you could certainly, in another setting, on another show, you could certainly explore that, where you did have a situation where a character like Vic, or maybe even Vic, you know, goes through that. It also gives me an idea, so I can drop my occasional Phineas and Ferb reference here. Imagine if Doofenshmirtz was a character on the holodeck, and he's always coming up with evil plans to get back at the crew of the station or his starship. That would be awesome.
That's true. I've actually never seen Phineas and Ferb, so I don't know that.
Everyone says
that
this.
Sounds,
you have to go watch Phineas and Ferb. One of the best things that Disney has produced in many years.
It's the one with that duck. Right, he has a duck face and he has the hat.
He's not a duck. He's a platypus in a fedora wheel. Come on.
I'm sorry. I don't know this show. I'll have to check it out now.
A duck. yeah, Perry the duck.
But I love when I see pictures of that platypus on like a t-shirt when I go to like shopping. I love it because I feel like it kind of looks like me when I have like, I just look, when I look frowning. So I feel like I need to own that shirt.
So here's something we need on the network. Of course, we already have Commander Flipper, as everyone knows,
true.
Who works down in Cetacean Ops on the Enterprise. We need also Commander Perry. They can hang out together. I mean, he's amphibious as well.
That should have been the show after Enterprise. Really. It led into it.
Perry
because
and
they
Flipper.
Were Zindi Aquatics. Wow, that was a big tangent. But to go back to what...
I don't think amphibious is the right word.
No.
But we don't need to go down that road. I'm sorry.
No.
All right. Well, he can get water. My point is he can swim with Commander Flipper. That's all.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah.
But to go to what Sue was saying about the difference between Vic and Moriarty, I think it could have gone darker if in the future episode, remember, I forget which name which episode name it is, but the one where he requests that his program is not shut down, that he's kept going in perpetuity, where he's learning and kind of lives his life.
Ship in a bottle, I believe.
Ship in a bottle.
Are you talking about Moriarty? Yeah. Ship in a bottle.
It could have been dark if they didn't entertain Vic's request. They actually did shut him down, and he didn't actually get to kind of get all his life experience. And I think that's something that they could have explored. Obviously, they didn't because they had other things to do, but it could have easily gone to an episode where they're just like, no, we're just going to shut you down. And that could be the genesis of him resenting and him realizing the fact that he really is just a tool. He's really just there as an accessory to other people's entertainment. And I think it's good that DS9 didn't go down that route, because I think they only had limited time to kind of cover what they needed to cover. But there is room there. I think you bring up a really good point in terms of the ethics of that, and it could have easily gone either way.
Ethically,
if they weren't
absolutely
as magnanimous.
The thing is, though, with I feel like the crew, especially Julian and Miles, and everyone makes Vic feel like he's part of the family. Like, he can't leave the holodeck, but I think he knows, and again, he's sentient, so he understands that they really appreciate him, and he is part of the family, and they come to him for advice. And so I think that it's not likely that he would go down that route, even though it's certainly possible and would make an interesting story if they did.
That's a good point. Do you think maybe they took the lessons from the Enterprise and then Felix put that into like an ethical subroutine that, you know, if we're going to give himself the ability to be self-aware, then we're going to build in extra layers of ethical subroutines to make sure he doesn't become crazy, right? He doesn't become incredibly consumed with envy.
Could be.
That's my soft canon.
But he's still essentially a slave.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, and I think... I mean,
that's the big issue with holograms on Star Trek, and we never really get a solution to that, because even by the end of Voyager, that really hasn't been fully solved. I mean, maybe in terms of the Doctor himself, he has more freedom, but you know that there are thousands and thousands of similar holograms in Starfleet at that point, and we never really know what the fate of those are on the television series.
Yeah, I think to take that in even like one more tangent, they could have taken an even much darker turn in terms of if they could build these self-aware holograms, and if using technology that Voyager did for the Doctor and for him to, you know, have that mobile emitter, what if they used mobile emitters to create holographic soldiers, and instead of having Starfleet die on the front lines, they were having holographic soldiers.
The problem with that is that the mobile emitter comes from the future and they only have one.
That's true.
I think of the problems with that.
Right. I feel like they could have figured out some fancy techno way to figure out, like, they also independently created something, like Section 31 perhaps created something. But I think that's a really interesting question, because you're right, Sue, is that his mere existence brings up interesting and potentially sobering questions that obviously weren't explored because they wanted to go on a more comical and more humorous route. But, you know, if they had extended that into the arc that DS9 was telling, it could have been very prescient with drones and how we use drone warfare now, and what is, you know, if we're putting these holograms and fighting and having them fight for us as vassals, are we no better than the Dominion, who use genetically engineered and drug-addicted soldiers, right?
Well, you do know that the U.S. military actually is exploring this very thing, the ability to project holographic warriors on the battlefield. So this is not something that's 24th century for us. I mean, this is something that within the 21st century could be a very, very real possibility, that that's how we're fighting wars. And...
But is the U.S. military going to give them intelligence? Or are they just intending to make their numbers look bigger than they are?
That's a good question.
They're already developing AI drones.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that...
I guess I'm using AI differently. I mean, like, sentience, because AI is different than sentience.
The thing is, I mean, it's a great question, because sentience... At the moment, we don't have the ability to do that, but I think that if we do have the ability to do that, and at some point we will, then for me, the most probable leap would be that they would give holographically projected soldiers sentience so that they can make decisions on the battlefield. I think that is the path that we would follow. And then you get huge ethical implications there.
I actually want to see this. I actually want to see this played out as an episode or a long season now, because it actually, it just builds up so much of these really interesting questions that are more relevant now than they were when it was first airing.
Or
so
you could watch Battlestar Galactica.
Right. Or I could watch that. Or I could. And they're both done by Ron Moore. So, I mean, there's that connection right there.
Exactly.
Or the Terminator.
That's true.
All right. Well, let's take a light twist here for a minute and shift gears and talk about a topic that it strikes me when I watch the beginning of the episode and the camera is panning across the lounge and I see married, almost dating, and Miles and Jules. You've got the three couples there in the lounge. You've got the apparently the bromance brewing over there. And I always wonder if the writers maybe staged it that way as a bit of an inside joke about Miles and Jules, because you do get, when you get to extreme measures at the end of season 7 and they think they're going to die, they actually have the conversation and Julian tells Miles, just admit it, you know, you do love me a little bit more than you love Keiko. And so I love this scene right here. What do you guys think when you see them in the lounge together?
I thought that it was pretty funny. I got a good chuckle out of it every time I see this episode. Even the first time I saw it, I was in college when it first came out. I'm watching that, and you've got Worf and Dax. You've got Kira and Odo, and Kira is giving some pretty significant looks to Odo. And then you've got Miles and Julian. I'm like, wait a second.
Right.
It's a triple date, guys. They all decided to go to see Julian's new hologram. So they're just like, right. Hey, you want to be my date? Okay. It works so well. I mean, I would totally watch a buddy cop movie or a spinoff, you know, like how Joni loves Chachi. It'd be Julian loves Miles, Miles loves Julian as a spinoff, because I feel like they have such a good dynamic and they could just, you know, rent an apartment together. It would work.
They do. How do you feel about it, Sue? I feel in terms of these types of friendships on Star Trek, Miles and Jules is probably my favorite one. It feels the most natural. Like, they really are two guys who really are just the best of friends. It feels similar to me as, like, Geordi and Data on TNG a little bit. And, I don't know, maybe the other one I think of is, like, Tom and Harry on Voyager, although that one doesn't work as well for me because they're very different from each other. And it almost feels like Tom is the cool guy and then Harry is the wingman that tags along.
I think that applies to Miles and Julian more.
Do you think so?
Because
I don't feel that way. Well, tell us why you feel that way. I'm curious.
I just get the impression, maybe it changes towards the end of the seasons or the end of the series, but that Miles and Julian are kind of friends because they're both there and they're both kind of alone. Even though Miles has Keiko, she's not around a whole lot and she kind of gets shafted a lot through DS9. Yeah. But he seems to get annoyed with Julian a whole lot. He seems to not enjoy it when he goes off. Julian goes off and does his technobabble stuff and goes off on these tangents. Yeah. The friendship that I really enjoy more is actually Julian and Garak.
Okay, yeah, that's a great one as well. Yeah.
And I mean, if you want to bromance or romance it too, I still prefer Julian and Garak.
Okay.
I think that's a really good point, but I think it's interesting how the Julian Garak friendship or their relationship tapers off when they bring in Miles and they pair them off. You just see like a significant drop off in like Julian and Garak pairings. You do see them have really great moments in the later seasons, but you just see them like not focus on it as much and focus on Miles and Julian pairing off. And that's a really good point, because at some point they just don't. Maybe we don't see it. Maybe it still happens, but we don't see them interact as much. And there's less of this almost kind of this mentor or this kind of older, more seasoned person trying to like mold this more naive doctor. That relationship completely changes when he pairs off with Miles and they do their own thing.
Right, because even from the beginning, they really push how young and naive Bashir is.
Yeah.
I think it stays that way. And I think Miles, having been through a lot and having seen everything, can get a little like annoyed, frustrated with the bright-eyed enthusiasm, maybe. But Garrick tapers off, doesn't he, because of how the Cardassians are positioned during the Dominion War.
Yeah, maybe. I think they all change a lot. Miles doesn't like Julian at the beginning, clearly, and that's one reason for me why the friendship feels very real, is that they get to know each other over time. They become very close friends, and they feel very natural together. And they do get irritated at each other, but I think that's part of being very close friends. Whereas Garrick and Julian, it's a relationship that's largely built out of mystery. And I think that Julian finds Garrick fascinating. And also, Julian has this love for spy games as well, because we've got the James Bond episode. And Garrick is the real-life spy, and that's very intriguing to him. And then on the flip side, I think Garrick almost, especially early on, enjoys just trying to play with Julian's mind a little bit. So it's a very different kind of relationship than the one that he has with Miles.
I kind of felt like it was very similar to some of the relationships I've seen from my time in the military with senior NCOs and the junior officers,
okay,
which these two are actually on the show. There's, you know, the senior enlisted people who have been in for decades, and they,
which is like Miles, you know, in this case.
Yeah, yeah. They've seen war, they've seen all kinds of things, just like Miles. And you've got these new guys that are pretty much straight out of the academy, straight out of college, that have no clue what they're doing or where they're going. And frequently, the most dangerous thing you ever hear out of a new lieutenant's lips is, in my experience. And a lot of the times, they'll have some other officer or senior enlisted that will take them under their wing and kind of guide them through as they develop in mm-hmm. their career. And I think that's kind of how things started a little bit with them when they got thrown together on in one of their early missions in season one. And from there, it just kind of grew, and they started to respect each other more, and it kind of branched out from that. And it felt pretty natural to me mm-hmm. From that perspective.
That's a great perspective. That's why I love when we have you guys who served in the military on the shows, because we have a number of hosts on the network who have served in the military, and we can always see that, because that's something, you know, I was not in the military, so I don't know how those relationships work. And since Starfleet is a military organization, that's great insight. Well, let's move on to the part of the episode that I know everyone is wondering when we're going to talk about, which is prepping Odo for romance. And he finds an unlikely mentor in the holosuite with a jazz crooner. And watching Odo come into his own and gain confidence and come out of his shell, because he really is, I mean, Odo is that guy who's in his shell all the time. And you're just waiting for him to break out. And then he does here. And it's really fascinating to see, particularly when he's playing the piano. There's the point where he's doing the Ryan up to the top. And the crowd loves it. And he just puts his hands, I don't know what's going on here. It's not me. And then by the end, he's like, yeah, it's all me. I'm so good. I'm really into this. Will, what did you think about Odo, Vic taking Odo under his wing?
I love it because it's the heart of the episode, right? So we've been talking so much about the setup for it, and there's a lot to set up, but like this is the heart of it, and it works so well. And I said at the front of the show too, this episode has no business being as good as it is. And the reason it is because of this dynamic, of this relationship, because James Darren is so fantastic, because Rene Auberjonois is so fantastic, because Nana Visitor is so fantastic. They sell the fact that it's kind of ridiculous. This shape-shifting, you know, blob of goo has to take romantic advice from this self-aware light bulb from the 60s, right? That's given this kind of like old-timer advice. He reminds me of like a hipper, cool, like uncle who's just stuck in like that time period. But, you know, he's giving you kind of like this, this kind of like almost like dating game advice, like from those old 70s TV shows, right?
Right.
And it's all, but it's packaged.
Now, that would have been a cool episode
if
they had a holodeck program where they were recreating the dating game.
And they just got it from historical records from the 1970s. They've recovered from the Third World War. They're just like, why don't we do this, right? And they'll, it's, ugh, it would work so well. But I think, you know, when you think about it, this episode shouldn't work because it's almost too unbelievable, even for a science fiction show. But because the acting is so on point and because it's so relatable, right? Because we all know someone that's like Odo, someone that means really well, but he just can't get himself to loosen up and to relax and to really let someone else in, right? And then another person's really trying, like, come on, man, you can do it. And he's more smooth and he's more at ease, he's more sociable. We've seen it in our daily lives. So that's why it's relatable,
yeah,
you know, in terms of watching it.
Well, and the man who is in love with a woman, but who is afraid to talk to her, afraid to act on it because he's afraid that he'll be rejected, is very, very common. That's everyday life. And so you see that right here with Odo as well.
I think it's kind of amusing that the first person that he opens up to about his feelings is Quark. And right. Quark didn't even come in for that. Quark's coming in to make a complaint, and Odo just spills his guts to him. And finally, Quark just tells him flat out, you're cold, rigid, and remote. Then Odo breaks down and asks for a favor. And you could just see the gleam in Quark's eye that Odo is asking for a favor. So you know it's going to come back to bite Odo later.
Oh, yeah.
And
but Odo and Quark are like the best of friends, really. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the great, you know, here's the sheriff and here's the criminal, but they're the best of friends. And you see that from the mm-hmm. beginning of the series all the way through the very end, when Odo leaves the station for the last time. And so it's not surprising to me that he would go to Quark for that help. If he's going to open up to anyone, it's probably going to be Quark initially.
Yeah. They're always in opposition to each other, but they can't live without each other.
Exactly.
And there's that great scene at the very end of the episode when Kira and Odo are kissing and they flash to Quark real fast. And Quark just gives this like, oh, yeah, like he's like actually legitimately happy. Like there's one moment where you see Quark, like he's like, yes, he actually did it. He was actually rooting for him. I think it was very, very subtle, but very well played on Armin Shimerman's part.
Definitely. What do you think about this, Sue?
I don't know. I feel like. Well, first of all, this is the scene where we're reminded that Odo's clothes are just him, so he's naked all the time, and that's uncomfortable.
He can be stylish at the snap of his fingers, though.
But he's naked all the time.
He is, right. It's like you see those photo spreads or like ads or something where they do the body paint to look like clothes. Yeah. It's like he's like that walking around the station all the time,
exactly.
I guess.
Exactly.
Right?
He's naked all the time.
So there's like a show title for you right there.
Perfect. So that is a little disconcerting. But as somebody who in real life is an introvert as well, that pushing can be very uncomfortable. And like I have extroverted friends who try and do this to me, and you just
talking
want
about
them
the pushing,
to back off.
Vic pushing Odo, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So you just it almost feels like he's pushing Odo to be something that he's not. And when you're trying to start a relationship, you don't want to start a relationship while you're not being yourself. And it gets worse, though, as it goes on, as he brings in the Lola hologram. You know, he's essentially making Odo act. And Odo has a very fair point when he comes back and he says, this isn't right because this isn't, first of all, this isn't how Kira acts. And secondly, I would never act this way in a real life situation. I can do this because of the abandon I feel in the holosuite, because I know it's not real.
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing I'm not very comfortable with, Vic tricks Odo when he brings in the real Kira the next time he's in the holodeck. And that is, well, first of all, I feel like making the Lola hologram look like Kira anyway is weird and invasive. But then tricking Odo is another thing that I don't love that Vic does. Because he's being deceitful to this person he's supposed to be mentoring.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think that is a very uncomfortable part of the episode. At the same time, I think that what we see from Vic here is it's appropriate for the character in that it's a lot like the 50s, 60s mentality in terms of parenting, the way you would push your children, which is very different than you do today. And it feels wrong to us, but probably right to Vic, because he sees it as what the others around him, and maybe his father was the same
right.
way to
and
him.
I guess that's where my discomfort with the situation lies when you boil it all down, is that Vic is giving advice to people in the 24th century from a 1960s perspective. And it's kind of like when Andy and I both react to the original series going through it. In 2015, it's dated, and it's at times uncomfortable, and it's at times especially uncomfortable for the women watching it. You know, like those two girls that he brings in to try and get Odo to loosen up a little bit. No.
Yeah, that was very weird.
Because they were programmed to already be. They were programmed to laugh at anything or to basically enjoy Odo, whoever was going to be Odo. They were programmed to already be essentially just love whoever that person was going to be, right? They're going to be on that person, or they're going to be, there's going to be no resistance, or there's going to be no type of, there's already one predetermined outcome. They were going to like that person. But I think to speak to your issue too, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think it would be much more problematic if Kira actually didn't reciprocate towards Odo, and that she had actually made it clear, because I know exactly what you're saying, right? It's the classic nice guy syndrome, right? Like, if I'm nice enough, I'm friend zoned, right? And I'm so nice, why can't she understand how nice and how much I care about her? Why can't she understand how great I am? And then when she realizes that, we'll be together, and there's a sense of entitlement that comes from that, which can be very toxic. And I can definitely see where that perspective is coming from.
So Odo needs Vic's help in breaking out of the friend zone.
Right. But
the friend zone is
so,
not a thing.
Right. But in real life, right? In real life, that could be very toxic, right? It could lend to itself to very toxic motives and toxic actions. I think it doesn't work here, because I think the episode still does a good job laying the foundation of saying Kira actually does have feelings for Odo too. And that they're just kind of in this weird zone where they just haven't expressed it to each other yet.
Right. And it's not out of the blue either. I mean, we know Kira has feelings for Odo before we get to this episode. And we know that Odo has feelings for her as well. I mean, you can go all the way back to, you know, Heart of Stone in episodes early on to know that.
Right. I'm just saying his advice in general throughout the series, anytime Vic appears, he's still coming from a perspective that is 400 years old.
And I like that, because I think that it's a great contrast to the world that they're living in. So for us as the viewer here, we can see advice that does feel antiquated to us now. It didn't feel as antiquated to us at the time that this originally aired, because that was two decades ago, but it still was feeling dated. It feels more so now, but it's still closer to our own time. And then seeing these characters in the 24th century being thrown into that environment, I think is very entertaining to watch, even if it's not how you would behave personally.
Yeah. And this is a total like in-universe type explanation. I don't know if it actually is even, I don't know if it actually is a justification in the sense that it's just kind of the in-universe explanation. But I think the reason why the Lola hologram looks like Kira is because I think he mentions it in the episode where it's a holdover from Ar-Bashir, right?
They were adapting the
transporter patterns. They beamed him over. And then the transporter pattern of Kira and her likeness got transported into the Russian
spy, and then
used the Russian spy. Right. I mean, yes, it's convoluted, and the larger point
but
of it is...
No, doesn't he say he gets her image from a security tape?
No, he said he got it from
Armand Bashir.
He said it took him an hour to get the Russian,
accent out.
Right, but I could have sworn he also said something about a security tape.
Yeah, I don't know if he did, but her image is in the computer because of Armand Bashir and what happened in that
right.
episode.
But, I mean, whether or not it's the image is available, You know, it's the same thing that Reg Barkley does in Hollow Pursuits. You know, he's taking the images of his senior staff, of the people who stress him out, and is putting them in these ridiculous situations on the holodeck.
Yeah.
And it's awkward and weird and not quite right.
Now, he could certainly have used someone else here. That's the thing. Like, he doesn't have to use Kira's image. And it would have been much more appropriate for him to use someone else. Because of the show, we want to have Nana Visitor in there. We want to have our main characters in there. And so they play it comedically that it's Kira and it's her image. In real life, definitely it would be inappropriate to do that.
Yeah, I think that's another thing with Star Trek is it's in service to a story, right? In service towards the narrative of the episode, right? Sometimes the ramifications of this technology, the ramifications of using this as a narrative device isn't fully explored, but you're right. I mean, what are the, I guess, for lack of a better term, what are the HR ramifications of in a workplace? There's a holosuite or a holodeck, right? Are there HR guidelines or are there societal guidelines or norms, right? On you can't actually create a holodeck replication or image of your superior officer, your coworkers, other people's family members and friends, and use them in your fantasy, which could be anything, right? Is there an NR-17 rating for holodeck recreations? I mean, do they have privacy for the rights?
Holosuites have NC-17 printed on the door.
Exactly, right? Can Cisco come in and say, I demand to see what you've been doing, right? And they never raise those questions because it's a show, but it's much like the economics of Star Trek, right? When you start thinking through it, you're like, wait a minute. This actually has some very interesting but also very sobering real-life ramifications that are never discussed. And you're right, the holographic technology, right, that's so revolutionary, that it's so groundbreaking, but yet we have no idea how it operates or what the societal norms or expectations are. And you could very easily go into situations where, yeah, it's a violation of someone's privacy. If you just replicate someone and be like, yeah, you're my boyfriend now.
Well, it would be like
or anything.
In real life, if you're making a movie when you're naming characters, if there's only one person with that name, you can't use that name. You have to choose something else. And so in real life, there's only one of any of us, right? So the same principle applied to creating holograms would mean that you can't create holograms of an actual person, period. It would pretty much be blanket. Now, I don't know, if you get into something like Thomas Riker and William Riker, does that make it okay? Well, of course it doesn't. But if you get into the there's only one person with this name, you can't use it idea.
Right. And I think there's also, to address your point, Sue, there could be an issue of personal ownership or personal level of comfort, because there was an early episode of DS9 where Kira does flip out because Quark actually sells to an alien the image of Kira, right? Yeah. And she is rightfully offended. She's like, that's a violation, right? She is totally offended. But in this instance, there seems to be no indication that she is at all offended that there's a Lola hologram or that there's a hologram that's impersonating her.
She didn't see the hologram. If she had walked in while the program was running, probably would have flipped out.
That's true.
Yeah.
And she did seem pretty upset that when she realized that Odo was under the impression that she was a hologram, which meant that Vic had told Odo that she was a hologram, which meant that, you know, as far as Odo knew, Vic had done that, and she was upset about that once again. And she looked at Vic and said, we'll have words later.
Yeah.
Yeah, and but it couldn't become a stumbling block in this relationship because they wanted them in a relationship in that classic rom-com I love you, well, I love you too situation at the very end.
Yeah.
So, Sue, you don't like the way this played out at the end?
Oh, no, I didn't say that.
Now, I'm curious. What do you think about how it played out? And Kira's reactions during the dinner and finding out that Odo thinks she's a hologram.
I mean, I know I would have reacted differently. I think they're a little bit unrealistic, but you know, these conversations are hard because we can talk about it in the in-universe way in terms of, like, this is totally unrealistic and that what we know of Kira Nerys is not how she would have reacted to this situation. Or we can talk about it in terms of they have 8 minutes left to get these two snogging on the promenade, you know? Mm-hmm. And from that perspective, from the story perspective, it makes sense. That shouting match is very classic rom-com. You can pull that out of any decade. That's in any, you know, the first thing that comes to mind, which is, I don't know what it says about me, but the the immediate movie I thought of was You've Got Mail, where, okay, you know, Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks hate each other in real life, but they really love, yeah, each other, but they hate each other, and they're screaming at each other until they start kissing, you know, which is the exact same thing that happens here. It's nothing new. It's certainly cute, and it fits with the atmosphere and the feeling of this episode, but it's not original in any way.
Sure. And since you bring up You've Got Mail, we should point out that rom-com means romantic comedy. It's not the name of the new communication system that Rom built that he's trying to sell to Starfleet.
Right, my bad.
Or a romantic comedy starring Rom, which would be really good. Rom,
which I would watch.
And also, when you just mentioned where two people hate each other, really like each other, and they'll start kissing, in my mind, I was like, that's the Odo Quark relationship that should have happened. They loved each other the entire time. And it's those two that should have been together, not Odo and Kira. It's been those two. They were the ones that
really
understood each
other. Odo leaves the station for the last time, that's what should have happened in the airlock. They yell at each other and then they start kissing. Quark and
I can't
Odo.
Live without you. I that would actually be really fantastic.
Are you really telling me you have to explain the term rom-com on Trek FM?
No.
Okay.
But since we have a character named Rom, it just seemed like a good opportunity.
All right.
I get where you're coming from, Sue. I really do. I think it just has to go with your levels of comfort of them using different tropes, because what they're using from the get-go really is a trope, right? Vic Fontaine is the device in which they're going to get Odo and Kira together. Right.
And I think I don't mind it so much because they're doing it with a wink. Like, they're not using the trope and just using it. They're saying, we're doing this kind of episode that has this kind of feel, it has this atmosphere, so we're going to throw in this too. So they're doing it with a nudge and a wink, and that makes it fun and, if not just, you know, passable or acceptable.
Yeah. But I think there's a crucial piece here where if there are certain factors or certain conditions that were tweaked either way, it could be very problematic indeed, right? So if this was a device that was used to win over Kira, and Kira was not interested in Odo whatsoever, she was not, and this was just a means to wear her down. Obviously, that's, you know, like the ultimate men's fantasy, right? Of just wearing someone down to say yes, all right, right? And I think that would have been problematic if there wasn't those things we had seen before in other episodes, the inklings of a relationship between Odo and Kira, and that they just, for some reason, they just haven't connected or communicated yet. I think without those elements, then you do have something that I think would be the less than the sum of its parts. But because you have this device, which is admittedly a trope, but I think because the acting is done really well, and because I think the characters are coming from a place of good faith, and I think the writers come from a place of good faith, it doesn't come off, at least for me, doesn't come off as something that's mean-spirited or potentially something that has really disturbing ramifications towards, like, this is how relationships work in the future. But I could see how, if you use a real-world analog, then you could see, like, I'm not sure if I'm, like, 100% on board with this.
Yeah, I'm not claiming that any of these potential hypotheticals that I bring up are intended. It's just sort of when you extend the metaphor, as you say, you start to think, well, that could get worrisome.
Yeah, it's true.
What do you think about the relationship itself between Odo and Kira, bringing them together? This has been such a long time coming when we get here. We go to situations like Worf and Troi, the relationship that no one wants to talk about on TNG, which was just kind of out of the blue. Let's just pair them together. But here you've got two very different people in Odo and Kira, and it's been brewing over most of the series. Again, I mentioned the Heart of Stone earlier on. You've got what happened in Children of Time that really threw a wrench into the potential relationship for a long time. You've got the tension at the beginning of this season between Kira and Odo because of Odo holing up in his quarters for so long with the female shapeshifter as well. And then they finally do come together here. And so it is a relationship that's not at all out of the blue, and one that I think a lot of fans were pulling for to happen. And so when it finally does happen, you feel like, okay, finally all this buildup in the writing has paid off, and then these two characters maybe should be together. How do you feel about it, Jeffrey?
I think they're, like you were saying, it was building up for a while, but it still felt a little odd to me. I just never quite saw the two of them getting together. I never really bought into the relationship that much. I mean, clearly it happened and it went on for the better part of a year until the end of the series when he left the station. But I always had a problem with it for some reason. I never quite understood why. I just never seemed quite right to me that those two got together.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think it's interesting because I think because the way this episode worked, I think how it just kind of, they had that very sudden ending. I think that ending almost took people by surprise, the fact that they just did it right in the promenade. I think it was effective because it subverted at least my expectations of how they would actually kiss for the first time or how they would kind of make it official. It was done the most public way possible. And I think that was something that at least subverted my expectations while watching it. I actually happen to like the relationship they have as it goes on through the end of the series. I think you see them both growing into the people that they are. And because they both have, in my mind, a similar narrative growth in terms of their characters, they both become, I wouldn't say softer characters, but they become more well-rounded characters, right? Initially, Oda's very stern and authoritarian.
I think Kira becomes softer over the course of the end of season six up into at least, you know, the midpoint of season seven personally. And I feel this relationship is part of the reason.
Right. I agree. I think I don't want to use the word soft in like a pejorative term, like she's not as still a confident woman or that she's still not the leader that she was before.
Well, Kira has a lot of anger in her at the very beginning of the series.
Right.
And it's softer in the sense that that's starting to dissipate.
Right. That's what I mean, yeah.
Not in the sense of weakness.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so that's so that's where I was going with Odo is becoming more well-rounded in terms of he is becoming more of a self-actualized person. He's not just this lawman, right? He's becoming something else because he knows where he's from. He finds his people and he becomes his own person.
He's the Kira sensitive sheriff, Will.
That's true. He is a sensitive sheriff. No longer just all about, like, you know, the regs and stuff. But with Kira, right, the same thing, right? She used to be this embittered terrorist resistance fighter, hated the Federation. And they got to a point where she realized that she could still be who she is, a patriot, but till the same time be a fully actualized person, have relationships. I think because they were growing, and they were growing at the same time, because they also were in the same time period, they're in the resistance, or they knew of each other at the same time, I think they both became more complete individuals. And I think because they became more complete individuals, they became more attractive to each other. That Oda became a more attractive person to be around. Kira became a more attractive person to be around in terms of their personalities, not because of their looks or whatever. They just became better people. They worked on themselves, and because they worked on themselves, they're going to be more open towards relationships with other people. And I think it fit really well because at the very end, I wouldn't say they were both damaged initially, but they did a lot of healing throughout the series. So by the time the seventh season, like, they really understood where each other were coming, like the opposite person was coming from. So
that's an interesting take on that. I think that Nana Visitor and Renee Auberjonois, the actors, have really fantastic chemistry. I don't think it makes as much sense for the characters. Also, because if you really think about it, DS9 starts pairing off towards the end. Like, there are just couples everywhere. And I feel like, maybe this is my own personal take on it and nobody else feels this way, but I feel like it starts to give the impression, especially with Kira and Odo, because they have worked together for so long and they have known each other for so long, even before what we know as DS9, the series begun, it can give the impression that men and women can't work together without becoming romantically involved. I'm not saying it does implicitly. Yeah. I'm saying it can. Because that's what keeps happening, you know? And there has never been so much romance on a Star Trek show before. Maybe they need it because they can finally have interpersonal arguments since Gene had passed away. Mm-hmm. But there is a lot of pairing off, and there is a lot of romantic entanglement on Deep Space Nine. And I personally have never been one for what I call unnecessary coupling.
But I think the kind of coupling is natural for people if you spend that much time together. Firstly, the show that needed the coupling that didn't have it was Voyager, because they needed to have children if they're going to get home, if you want to make the show realistic. But that's for another discussion as well. Yeah, I don't know. I see what you're saying, Sue. I think it's natural, though, that people who work together do end up having feelings like that. Not everybody, of course, but if you're in a situation where you have that many people together, you are going to have people who pair off. And now maybe the number of people here who are pairing up who are on the senior staff is an unusually high number. I would agree on that.
Right, but I guess my point is that by the end of the show, the only friendship, really strong friendship between a man and a woman that's left is Jadzia and Sisko. Yeah. And he's not really friends with Jadzia. He's still basically friends with Curzon.
He's friends with Curzon, yeah.
So it, like, there are no really friendships.
Or like Kira Sisko, though.
I see yeah. that more as mentor mentee.
Yeah.
I'm and talking for Kira, like one-on-one peer friendships.
Yeah.
There are none between men and women on Deep Space Nine. And that is disappointing to me. Because
I think
there's more than one kind of relationship.
Right. I would disagree. I think they're actually closer than you think they are. I think
you're talking about Kira and Sisko, Will?
Kira and Sisko, yeah. Okay. But also at the same time, I think DS9 has more of a workplace feel. So I think there are only the more legitimate friendships, the friendships that we more relate to, only happen, I guess, at the lower levels between, like, let's say a Julian and a Miles, right? Or between a Jadzia or a Kira. But I think because there's a first officer and there's a commanding officer relationship, there is kind of a distance. But I think by the end of the series, they are closer than they initially were at the beginning. I think there was a lot more bonding. Yeah.
But with Kira and Sisko, the thing is that relationship is always colored from Kira's perspective in that Sisko is a religious icon to her. Mm-hmm. And that's something that she never escapes from. And even after Sisko himself accepts the fact that he is the emissary and learns that he is in fact of the prophets, that I don't think that he sees himself as a religious icon to her, but she definitely does the other way around. So I don't think that it's even possible for them to have the kind of friendship that we're talking about.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think maybe it's not friends as we would define them. Mm-hmm. I think they were still more than just a workplace relationship. It was still more than just a first officer or a commanding officer relationship.
I would agree with that. But you have that. I mean, Sisko is definitely, I think, more open and more, caring is the right word, but his relationship with Kira is closer and deeper than Picard's relationship with Riker.
I was just going to say
Janeway's relationship with Chakotay for sure, because Janeway's pretty much, it's like Charlie Brown's mother talking on the phone when Chakotay gives her ideas. And then,
Chakotay's the worst.
Well,
I mean, what?
We'll save that for our Voyager show.
Please don't send me hate mail.
but to your earlier point, too, about how the relationships pair off, I would say that would be a stronger point if there was more casual relationships that you would see developing, that you'd see, like, one season there'd be one character with one character and they would end and they would pair off or hook up with another character. I think what you have with Deep Space Nine is that you eventually have stable relationships that form, that you don't have. I mean, yeah, you have dating, but you don't have dating and mixing and matching between the characters that you see, that you have these relationships that develop and then relatively stay the same.
So your point is that it's not friends.
What was that? Yeah, I mean, I would say there's a spectrum, right? So it's not like friends, but it's also not like how sometimes real life would work too, right? Where everyone can just have a
male
and female.
I'm seeing Aaron creating a new chart for the network with the degrees of friendship.
Because in real life there are different degrees of friendship, right? So I think this is just that one type of portrayal of relationships. You have the friends model, then you have kind of one where it's very strictly workplace, where they can just be colleagues, and then you have a DS9, which is kind of in between, right?
All right. Well, we have gone way past an hour here, so we should wrap up our discussion with our final thoughts and our ratings. So, Sue, what are your final thoughts on the episode, and what's your rating?
My final thoughts on this episode are to give props to Nana Visitor for her performance while she is Lola in the holodeck. Her physicality has always kind of reminded me of Bebe Neuwirth.
In case that
name is not familiar, she actually was on The Next Generation for one episode, but she is a Broadway singer and dancer. And while not trained,
most people know her as Lilith on Cheers and Frasier.
But that's not entirely accurate to Bebe Neuwirth.
But
while not trained, Nana Visitor gives a wonderful performance as Lola, and it's really fantastic. Rating. I feel like I was the downer of this episode, but I actually enjoy it from an entertainment standpoint. So I will give this 7 out of 10 crooners.
Excellent. How about you, Jeffrey?
Well, even though I like I said, I'm not the biggest fan of the Odo Kira relationship. I mean, I always saw them more as colleagues, and they had a long time respect for each other, but I just never saw them getting together romantically. I still really enjoy the episode, especially because it introduced Vic Fontaine, and he was just really a great thing to add to the show for that final 28 episodes or however many there were after this point. And I'd have to give it, I would say, 4 singing founders.
That's a good rating. All right. So how about you, Will?
I really enjoy this episode. I think it wouldn't really work with any other series. I think this one just works because of various reasons. So I really enjoy it. I think it's the best use of Vic Fontaine. He's going to be a pretty big character through the rest of the series, but I think this is his best appearance. So for me, I'm going to give it 4 out of 5 Harveys.
Excellent. Well, I also really enjoy this episode. As I said at the beginning, the mere fact that they made jazz a part of Deep Space Nine and they kept that going was just fantastic. And somewhere along the way, the writer said that they knew when they brought Vic on the show and the studio didn't say anything, like, you can't do that. They knew that we can do whatever the hell we want with this show. And I'm so thankful that was the case. And I'm so thankful that the studio's attention was on Voyager and they just let DS9 do its thing. And so we got this great run all the way through to the end with these great stories. And I think it's one reason why today, more and more, DS9 is being viewed by fans as the best Star Trek series. It's the series that the stories stand the test of time the best and still connect with you as the years go by. And again, it's because it is about the characters. And Vic brings the characters to life in a way that may not have been possible in the midst of the war through the end of the series, if they didn't have this character that they could draw upon from time to time. And so it was just such a wonderful addition. And I was also glad to see the Odo Kira relationship play out finally in the end, because it had been building up for so long. And you kind of feel for Odo, because Odo is a lot like Spock and Data. He's that character on this show where he's that outsider who's trying to find a way to fit in and trying to understand what it means to be human. I'm going to do air quotes because we have a lot of races in Star Trek, and I don't want to offend the Klingons by talking about inalienable rights or anything like that. But seeing Odo fall in love with Kira and then it actually be reciprocated, for me, was something I wanted to see. So I really love this episode. James Darren is absolutely fantastic. He's so natural. I love the fact that when he talks about Frank and Dean, I mean, these are people he knew. So it's not an actor getting up there talking about Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra. I mean, he knew them. It's so authentic. They could not have found anyone better to play this role. And if you don't have the album that came out called This One's From the Heart, with all the songs that he sang on the S9, go get that, because it's really a fantastic album.
I forgot he actually did. I remember that now. Yeah, yeah, he did do that.
It's a great album. I still listen to it to this day. So I'm going to give this episode 9 bottles of Dom Perignon.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Fancy.
All right. Fancy rating today. All right. Well, thank you for joining us today, guys. Jeffrey, before we go, tell everyone where they can find you elsewhere around the interwebs and here on the network.
Well, I have been appearing as a frequent guest on Warp 5 with Will and Norm, and I also post regularly on the Babel Conference. In addition to that, I also have my Twitter handle. It's @Harlander. I also do a comic book as well, The Protectorate, and that's also on Facebook. Just search for Bandwidth Comics, or it's bandwidthcomics.com.
Okay, so is your comic only available on Facebook, or can people get it somewhere else?
No, it's if you go to the bandwidthcomics.com, okay, it's got links directly to buy it online.
Oh, awesome.
It's digital and print.
Oh wow, that's fantastic. All right, I'll have to check that out myself. All right. And Sue, tell everyone where they can find you around the interwebs and on the network.
Right here on the network. You can find me on Women at Warp. And we're also over at womenatwarp.com. And I also podcast and blog for the Anomaly Podcast at anomalypodcast.com. And that is where all of my, what I call the TOS project posts are.
Okay.
So my lifetime of being a Star Trek fan, I watched TOS and TAS for the first time in the last year. And all of those reactions are snarking away over on anomalypodcast.com.
Okay, excellent. Are you on Twitter?
I am on Twitter as Spaltor, Spaltor. And that is because I can sing soprano, alto, or tenor.
Oh, wow. All right. So no baritone, though, no bass. You have to bring
Sadly,
someone else
no.
in for that.
Yeah, I don't go that low.
To the full spectrum. Okay, excellent. Well, thanks for joining us today, guys.
Thank you.
It was really great talking his way with Jeffrey and Sue. It was a really lively discussion.
Yeah, it was great. It was really fun. There's so much to cover in that episode. We went way over our normal time. I was watching the time tick by. I'm like, wow, I got to get into the final thoughts here, but I was really enjoying the conversation. And for an episode that when you're watching it, because the time is padded a lot with these long jazz performances, right?
Yeah.
We still found so much to talk about. So I hope everyone enjoyed that. But it's not the only thing we've been talking about on the network recently. So here's a look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
You know, watching it live to 3 months after the series ends to watch the Mirror Universe episodes.
You're like, whoa, man, I heard season 3 got dark, but this is crazy.
It got darkly.
Oh.
Earl Grey.
We divide the ship into one of two ways. Port goes to port. I better not see any starboard guys on the starboard phaser target practice. You guys know which side of the ship you're on.
The Orb.
And so they cannot impart to him the knowledge that he needs in order to raise his son. And Worf doesn't want to raise a human son. Like you said earlier, he didn't get the son that he wanted. He wants to raise a Klingon son.
The Ready Room.
We knew that Spock was popular, and we knew that Dad had some fans, but we were not prepared for what we saw happening in the social media, in the print media. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the New York Times reported that they got more hits on Dad's obituary than any other personality in the history of the paper.
To the journey! You're not a member of our race or a member of our culture, so we're going to say no.
That's kind of boring, and yet I don't know what else to do.
Oh, screw you!
Sorry, buddy.
Warp 5.
I remember watching Broken Bow when Enterprise first debuted when I was in high school. I remember revisiting it now in full, and I had forgotten the fact that Future Guy had actually played an integral role from the get-go, with Silic and the Suliban, which we'll talk about later in the show.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
It's all of these top-notch filmmakers, like people like Walter Murch, who literally wrote the book on editing. He, like, those guys all teaming up to make a big action kids movie, I think is really cool.
The 602 Club.
I think he's very much recreating that THX feel, and you may disagree with it. You may not think it's, you know, it's great, but it's on purpose. He wants that world to be that way.
Let me just say, conceptually, I agree with that. In terms of execution, that's where I think he failed.
Literary Treks.
It's amazing to me, as I reread these stories, how much of it I just kind of think of as Deep Space Nine these days, even though it wasn't part of Deep Space Nine, you know, the actual series.
Axanar, the official podcast.
It is the spirit of TOS that matters, that's being captured, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the aesthetic. The aesthetic was 1966 to 1969 that had its moment, it had its time, and there's a certain amount of charm still to that. But it doesn't allow you to push the narrative forward because that type of aesthetic holds creativity back, in my opinion.
Women at Warp.
So she definitely knows cats. I say that right off the bat.
She knows cats and Bones.
Yes, definitely. Of course Bones would get annoyed with all the cat fur.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what else we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere that you get your podcasts. Of course, we're on iTunes. We're also on Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud, Spreaker. You can go to the website, stream from the show page. You can download the MP3 file. You can grab the RSS link. We're available everywhere that audio leaks from your speakers. So please tune in and hear what we're talking about from all over the world of Star Trek and other areas too, like science and creatives beyond Star Trek. We're talking about all kinds of stuff here on the network. If you're in iTunes, please take a moment and leave us a star rating and a written review. We love to hear what you think about the show. And also, because of the way that the iTunes search algorithms work, show titles important, but also star ratings and written reviews and lifetime subscribers as well. So if you're just streaming the show through iTunes and you're not subscribed, go ahead and click subscribe. That helps us. And also you'll get the new show as soon as we put it out. Sometimes it takes like a day or two for the show to actually show up in iTunes after it's published, if you're looking in the store. But if you're subscribed, it just goes straight out to your device. So it's there. It's just not showing up in the iTunes store yet. Now, if you'd like to share your thoughts on today's show, we'd definitely love to hear those. There are many ways for you to do that. The best, the most interactive way is the Babel Conference, which is our listeners group on Facebook. Will, tell everyone a little bit about the Babel Conference.
So the Babel Conference is our dedicated Facebook listeners group where it's a closed group just for listeners, and it's a place where we can talk everything about Star Trek and what we were talking about on the shows and talking about future content and everything about Star Trek. So it's just a really great place for really in-depth but respectful and intelligent conversation. I think we've had some terrific threads, just terrific opinions and perspectives and analysis there. So if you listen to the show, you should definitely come check it out. If you type in Babel into the Facebook search bar, B-A-B-E-L, it should pop up. Send us a request. We'll let you in and just join the discussion there, because it's a really great place to just listen to the show and also contribute about your thoughts on it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Come join us there. It's great. We actually had a discussion this week, which in most Facebook groups would have turned into a shouting match and a flame war. And it was great. I mean, it was like, you know, being on the ready room here. We had this discussion with a lot of listeners. I really love that. There are other ways. I know not everyone's on Facebook, so there are other ways for you to talk to us as well. We're on Twitter. Our username there is TrekFM, and we love chatting with our listeners on Twitter. So if you send us a message, we will reply. We'll talk to you over there. Also, our website, trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the ready room. That'll come to me by email. You can even send us a voicemail at speakpipe.com/trekafilm. That's the word speak and the word pipe.com/trekafilm. You just need the mic that's built into your computer or your smartphone or your tablet. You can record a message, and just with a click, you can actually upload that to us right there from the webpage. So you don't need any fancy equipment to send us a voicemail, and you don't need to make a phone call and, you know, pay long distance charges or anything like that. Technology's wonderful, right, Will?
I feel like voicemail is almost like this It's wonderful I could do voicemail on a web browser, because for me, voicemail is like almost like it's antiquated. It sounds crazy. Right. Like,
yeah. It really
does. I love the fact that we can do like a voicemail 2.0. So that's wonderful. Go ahead and do that.
Absolutely. So those are ways you can get in contact with us, and we would love to hear from you. Now, Will, when you're not getting fitted for your dress by Garrick, so you can go in and have Nana teach you how to perform Fever in a seductive manner, where can people find you?
People can find me on Twitter. I'm just laughing because, oh man, that would... I think I may be one of those lost causes. I don't think Nana could actually teach me how to do that, but that would be very amusing to try regardless. But you can find me on Twitter at @will_Nguyen, spelled N-G-U-Y-E-N. And of course, you can find me in the Babel Conference. I'm always there talking almost every day about everything Trek. And then you can also find me on my email at will.win@trekfm. I'm also the content manager for the network. So if you feel like there's something we haven't talked about, or you want to talk about what we've already talked about, feel free to drop me a line and I'll get back to you.
Great. And I'm picturing like a behind the scenes video of you being taught how to perform Fever.
I feel like
the kind of supplemental content that our patrons want, Will.
That's why they're paying $50 right. a month. It's to see me try to be like Nana Visitor singing Fever. I really feel like that's the type of value-added material that should be on a DS9 Blu-ray.
Yeah, we got to get to work on that. All right. Well, if you'd like to find me, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. You can also find me on Facebook. That's my username there. I'm in the Babel Conference. I'd love to chat with you over there. And here on the network, you can find me doing Hyperchannel from time to time. That's a short news show. I do it when there's something that I feel like I want to talk about news-wise. And you can also find me on The Orb with Matthew Rushing. We do that every week. We're trying to get it back to weekly right now. It's all about Deep Space Nine, very in-depth. I think I mentioned Matthew and The Orb a number of times in the discussion today. If you love Deep Space Nine, you need to be listening to The Orb. So go find that elsewhere on the network. And then you can find, as I mentioned at the beginning, my new column on StarTrek.com is up. It's called Trekspectives. I'll be writing that monthly for the official site. So go over and check that out if you haven't read it yet. And let me know your thoughts on what I talk about there. And you can find me on my personal website as well, cbrianjones.com. And there I tend to write about stuff that's not about Star Trek. So if you want to read about music and things like that, that's where you can go.
Oh, and I just remembered, I'm also the co-host of Warp 5. How can I forget
that? Oh, you forgot. Sure. I was thinking Will needs to mention Warp 5, and then I was thinking about the dress, and then I forgot. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
It happens typically when you're thinking about that dress.
It does.
Well, no, but I'm actually the co-host of Warp 5 with Norman Lau, and we're talking all things Enterprise. So not only am I a big Deep Space Nine fan, I'm also a big Enterprise fan. So that's all things NX-01, all things Warp 5. So check us out there.
That's right. Speaking of that, did you notice Jeffrey Combs in this episode today?
You know, I didn't know he was there until you pointed it out, and I'm like, of course he would. I feel like the guy's on retainer. When he was on Star Trek, he was just the go-to guy. Like, hey, Jeff, we're going to need you to play this random role. Can you be there? He's like, yes, I will be there. And he's going to absolutely kill it as a drummer, as an Andorian, as a Ferengi. Andorian, doesn't matter. He's just going to bring his Jeffrey Combness, which is complete awesomeness, to that role. So
that's right. Yeah, according to our show notes, he was the drummer. I don't know if that's true or not. I thought he might have been the mic, but he was there. All right, Will, let's wrap up this show today. I'm going to go back down to Vic's because I'm going to see if he can play some Basin Street Blues for me, because for me as a trombonist, that was the first jazz piece I ever performed.
I agree. It's definitely time to stick a fork in that oyster Rockefeller, because this Ready Room is over.